Okay, well, again, everybody knows what I'm fixing to say, so I'll just do it. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. It's the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, in the wilderness, chapter 8. And it actually starts kind of, sort of, in the second verse. You could say it starts in the first verse, but we see this one fairly frequently. It says, "And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said..." Here we go. "Speak unto Aharon and say unto him the following." Okay, well, so far, that isn't the unique word that's going to name the parsha. "When you light the lamps," the seven lamps that shall give light in the front of the menorah he's talking about. And that word in the Hebrew is Baha Alotcha, or sometimes you'll see it, and I think at least the way I read the vowel pointers, it's Beha Alotcha, but they say Beha Aloteka too. In any case, has to do with lighting of the lamps, and it's also said to be in the first month, while the people of Israel, the sons of Israel, Kol Israel, were traveling the Midbar in the wilderness. So with that, let's see what it says. Aaron did so. He lighted the lamps thereof so as to give light in front of the menorah. And some Bibles translate this as candlestick, which really seems kind of silly. This is one of those words that really, it's a specific thing. Let's just leave it in the Hebrew, the menorah, the seven-branch menorah, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. And as you know, when we see those words, I like to emphasize, "as Yahuwah commanded Moshe," because it appears a lot, and he did as commanded. And obviously, because it keeps telling us that, that's important. "And this," it says, "was the work of the menorah. It was a beaten work of gold under the base thereof, all the flowers, one beaten work." Literally, it was made out of a single piece of gold to start with. "This was done according to the pattern which Yahuwah showed Moshe, and so," it says, "he made the menorah." Then it says, "Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, 'Take the Levites from among the B'nai Israel and cleanse them.'" Now, this is kind of interesting, too. Remember, there's a lot of Levites at this point. This includes more than just the tribe of, the family of Moses, the Kohanim, and even more than just the Kohathites. It includes several other clans as well. "Cleanse them. So here's what you're going to do to them, to cleanse them. Sprinkle the water of purification upon them. Let them cause a razor to pass over all of their flesh, then let them wash their clothes and cleanse themselves." So they basically are going to be shaven clean. "Then let them take a young bull, along with its meal offering, fine flour mingled with oil. Another young bull you'll take for a chatat, a sin offering, and you'll present the Levites before the tent of meeting, the Mishkan. Assemble the whole congregation, kol edat, right there, of the B'nai Israel." So everybody's going to be there. Remember, this is a whole lot of folks. This is arguably multiple millions at this point. 603,550 men of war, at least of the age, to be able to go to war, and all the wives and children that go with them. "So you present the Levites before Yahuwah, and the B'nai Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites." Now, there's 22,000 of the Levites. Remember, they replaced the firstborn. So this is a whole lot of people in this ceremony. "And Aaron," it says, "shall offer the Levites before Yahuwah as a wave offering." I guess if you've ever seen, you know, like a wave at a major stadium, this is probably a lot bigger than that. Think about it. "A wave offering from the B'nai Israel so that they may be able to do the service of Yahuwah. Levites then shall lay their hand upon the heads of the bulls and offer the one for a chatat, a sin offering, the other for an olah, a burnt offering unto Yahuwah, to make atonement for all of them," all of the Levites. "Then you'll set the Levites before Aaron and before his sons, and offer them for a wave offering before or unto Yahuwah. And thus," it says, "you shall separate the Levites from among the B'nai Israel, and the Levites," literally, "are mine. After that, the Levites shall go in to do the service of the Mishkan," all the things that by their family is going to do. "Then you'll cleanse them and offer them for a wave offering, because," he says, "they are wholly given unto me from among the B'nai Israel." Instead of, and this word is tachat, in place of, those who were the firstborn, the ones that opened the womb, the firstborn of all of the B'nai Israel, "I've taken them unto me. For all of the firstborn are among the children of Israel are mine, both man and beast. On the day that I smote the firstborn in the land of Egypt, Mitzrayim, I sanctified them, I set them apart for myself. And I have taken the Levites, tachat, Now remember, this is the same word, I like to emphasize this one too, an eye in place of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, you've heard, but tekat means literally in place of. And this is the Levites in place of the firstborn among the B'nai Israel. And I've given the Levites, they're given to Aaron and his sons from among the B'nai Israel, to do the service of Israel in the Mishkan, the tent of meeting, make atonement for the children of Israel, so that there will be no plague among the B'nai Israel through the children of Israel coming nigh unto the sanctuary. So there's a continual warning on that front. Thus did Moshe, and did Aaron, and all of the congregation of the B'nai Israel unto the Levites, according to all that Yahuwah commanded Moshe, touching the Levites. So the children of Israel did unto them. And the Levites purified themselves, they washed their clothes, Aaron offered them for a sacred gift before Yahuwah. Aaron made atonement for them to cleanse them, and after that the Levites went in to do the service, avodah, in the Mishkan before Aaron and before his sons. Again, here's this words, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe concerning the Levites, so did they unto them. All right, then it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, this is that which pertains unto the Levites. From 25 years old and up until the age of 50, they shall go in to perform the service in the work of the Mishkan, tent of meeting. And after 50, they will return from service. In other words, they retire, is what we'd say nowadays. They serve no more. But they minister with their brethren in the tent of meeting to keep the charge. But they do no manner of service. So they're basically, what would be the word? Levites emeritus at this point. And this you shall do unto the Levites, touching their charges. All right, chapter 9 is going to talk about what is said to be the only Pesach that was celebrated in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, I don't know that that's completely verifiable, but it's certainly something that you'll hear fairly frequently. Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe, Bamidbar Sinai, in the wilderness of Sinai, the first month of the second year. Okay, so this is the second year, first month, after they had come out of Mitzrayim. And he said, let the children of Israel keep the Pesach, Ha Pesach, in its appointed season. In the 14th day of this month, at dusk, you keep it in its appointed season, according to all the statutes, the Huchat of it, and according to all the ordinances thereof, you shall keep it. So Moshe spoke to the B'nai Israel that they should, in fact, keep the Pesach, and they did. They kept the Passover in the first month, 14th day of the month, at dusk, Bamidbar Sinai, according to all that Yahuwah commanded Moshe, so did the B'nai Israel. Now, there were certain men, though, that because they were unclean, because they had come in contact with a dead body, so they couldn't, because they were, again, unclean, they couldn't keep the Passover on that day. So they came before Moshe and Aaron, and they said, hey, we're unclean. We've been in contact with a dead body of a man. So are we to be kept back, not able to bring the offering of Yahuwah in its appointed season among the B'nai Israel? This is a serious thing. They're concerned. So Moshe said, hey, hang on, stay tuned. Y'all stay here that I may hear what Yahuwah will command concerning you. And obviously he did, because the next paragraph says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak in turn to the children of Israel, and say to them, if any man of you of your generations shall be unclean, for example, by reason of a dead body, or he's on a journey afar off, yet he shall keep the Passover unto Yahuwah. So here's the mechanism. Second month, not the first month, but the second month, a month later, on the 14th day at dusk, they shall keep it. They eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. Let none of it remain unto morning. Notice this is going to sound a lot like the exact set of commandments for the first one. Nor do they break a bone of it. According to all these statutes of the Passover, they shall keep it. But a man that's clean and it's not on a journey, well, basically he's without excuse. If he doesn't keep the Passover, that soul shall be cut off from his people, because he has not brought the offering of Yahuwah in its appointed season. That man shall bear his own sin. Now, if a stranger is among you sojourning, and he'd like to do it, keep the Pesach unto Yahuwah, according to the statute of the Passover, the chuk, and according to the ordinance, he shall do so. You shall have a statute echad, or echat in this case, one, unified, for both the stranger and for the homeborn. And on the day that the tabernacle was reared up, the cloud covered the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and at evening there was upon the Mishkan, as it were, the appearance of fire until morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it and the appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tent, well, it's time to go. Then the children of Israel journeyed, and the place where the cloud abode, where it stopped, that's where they camped. At the commandment of Yahuwah, the children of Israel journeyed, and at the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped. As long as the cloud abode upon the tabernacle, they stayed put. And when the cloud tarried, sometimes it was many days, well, then the Bnei Israel kept the charge of Yahuwah, and they didn't go anywhere. They journeyed not. Sometimes the cloud was just on the Mishkan for a few days. According to the commandment of Yahuwah, they remained encamped. And according to the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. He's making a really clear point. When the cloud goes, you go. When it doesn't, you stay. Sometimes the cloud was from evening till morning, and when it was taken up in the morning, they journeyed. Or if it continued by day and by night, when the cloud was taken up, they went. Whether it's 2 days or a month or a year, the cloud tarried upon the Mishkan, abiding thereon, and the Bnei Israel remained encamped. Sometimes they went for a long time. They journeyed not, but when it was taken up, it was time to go. At the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped, and at the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. This is the real key. They were in the wilderness, Bamidbar, and it was all about him. When it was time to go, he told them. When it was time to stop, he told them, and they did so. At the commandment of Yahuwah, by the hand of Moshe. Chapter 10 says, well, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, get yourself, make two trumpets, and zotzrot. These are silver trumpets. They're made out of kesef. And by the way, notice it's translated as silver. They're not money. Not two trumpets made out of money. This is the same thing, though. They're made out of silver. They are of beaten work. You make them. And they shall be for you. In other words, you use them to call out the congregation and for causing the camps to set forward. Now, there's going to be a description of how this works. But basically, they know that when the cloud moves, it's time to go. Still, though, we need some organization. It's not just everybody get up and go at the same time when we have chaos. They are going to move in an order, and that order is going to be laid out right here. When they blow with them, notice it's plural there, kol ha'edah, all of the congregation shall gather themselves unto you at the door of the tent of meeting. Now, there's a lot of people here, obviously. That's a big crowd. They can't all gather at the door, but they're around. If they blow but with one of these trumpets, then the leaders, the princes, the heads of the thousands will gather themselves unto you. So if it's just one trumpet, it's only the leaders. But when they blow an alarm, a teruah, that's the nine short blasts, the camps that lie first on the east side will take their journey. Remember, that's starting with Judah. Well, at least among those camps that are not at the Mishkan. When you blow an alarm the second time, the camps on the south shall go forward. And you blow their alarm for their journeys. When the assembly is to be gathered together, you blow, but you do not sound the teruah. And the sons of Aaron, the Kohanim, will blow with the trumpets. This shall be unto you a statute, a chukat olam, statute forever, throughout your generations. When you go to war in your land against an adversary that oppresses you, then you shall sound the teruah, an alarm with the trumpet, plural trumpets. And you shall be remembered before Yehuyarel and be saved from your enemies. This sounds like a very positive thing. The enemies are coming, and you sound the alarm with the teruah with the trumpets, and you shall be saved from your enemies. Also, in the day of your gladness, in your appointed seasons, your new moons, you blow with those trumpets. Over your burnt offerings, over your sacrifices of your shalomim, your peace offerings, this shall be to you a memorial before Elohim, your El, Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. Now, it came to pass, then it said, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month. Remember, the 14th day of the month begins the time of Pesach with the meal, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We got a week then following that of unleavened bread and the time where there is no leaven to be found. And it came to pass then at the end of that time, the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the Mishkan, of the testimony. And the children of Israel, as you already have understood, they set forth by stages out of Bamidbar Sinai. And the cloud abode Bamidbar Paran, the wilderness of Paran. There they took their first journey, according to the commandment of Yahuwah, by the hand of Moshe. And in the first place, the standard of the camp, the children of Judah set forward, according to their hosts. Over his host was Nachshon, son of Aminadab. Now, what we're going to get here is a listing of all of them taking their first journey as they set out. Second host, Issachar, the leader of which was Nathanael, son of Zuar. The number three was Zebulun, and the leader there was Eliab, son of Helon. Then the Mishkan was taken down. The sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who bore the Mishkan, set forward. So we have the tribes to the east. Then the Mishkan's taken down, and the load bearers, Gershon and Merari, they set out. Then the standard of the camp of Reuben set forward according to their hosts. And the leader there was Elitzur, son of Shedeur. And over the host of the tribe of Simeon, we have Shelumiel, son of Zuri Shaddai. And finally, Gad, whose leader was Eliasaph, son of Deuel. Then the Kohathites, the bearers of the sanctuary itself. So remember, these are not the Kohanim, but they are the same tribe as the sons of Aaron. And they are carrying all of the golden articles, the appurtenances of the Mishkan itself, so that the tabernacle might be set up against their coming. Then, we're going to go to the west side, standard of the camp of Ephraim, the Benai Ephraim, children of Ephraim, they set forward. And among them, the leader was Elishama, son of Amihud. Next, Manasseh, whose leader, Gamaliel, the son of Pedatzur. And finally, Benjamin, the leader of that tribe, Abidan, son of Gideoni. Then we get to the north side, where Dan set forward, according to their hosts, and their leader, Ahiezer, son of Amishaddai. Then next, Asher, who was led by Pagiel, son of Ochran. And finally, Naphtali, led by Ahira, son of Enan. Thus, it says, were the journeys of the Bnei Israel according to their hosts, and they set forward. So you can imagine, you know, quite a scene with basically close to 3 million people, men, women, children, tents, animals, and an entire huge camp, literally a city, moving out. Moshe said to Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite. Now, Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite. This is another one of the names that we seem to have for Moshe's father-in-law. And, Jethro sometimes, here he is Reuel, the Midianite. Anyway, his son Hobab. And Moshe said, we're journeying unto the place which Yahuwah said, I'll give it to you. Come with us, we'll do you good. And Yahuwah has spoken good concerning Israel. And this time Hobab says, well, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my own kin. Well, the response was, don't leave us, I pray, for as much as you know how we are to encamp in the wilderness, you shall be to us instead of eyes. We can really use your help here. It'll be with, if you go with us, yea, it shall be, that whatsoever good Yahuwah shall do to us, the same we will do unto you. So they set forward from the mount of Yahuwah 3 days' journey. The ark of the covenant of Yahuwah went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. Now, these are the last three verses of chapter 10. And here I'm going to make one more note, because at this point, we're going to see, it says, and the cloud of Yahuwah was, wait a minute, okay, here comes one of these jots and tittles, the scribal notations, one of the probably most unique in the whole Torah. And again, note, these do not show up in the English. I've never, hardly ever at least, I can't remember even seeing a footnote in the English. But this is what's called the inverted noons. This is a noon that is backwards from normal. It looks like a bracket. And it looks like basically the open bracket. And in this case, it's not an open bracket and a closed bracket. It's two open brackets. But the sages seem to think this is to set these last couple of verses apart. And I've heard all kinds of comments about this. The one I like is, the inverted noon set off what's been called the book never written. Like, there's a whole bunch of stories here that are encapsulated within this little set off set of brackets. And it goes like this. It came to pass, whenever the ark set forward, that Moshe said, now we've heard these words, and now you know why they're set off, maybe. Rise up, rise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let them that hate you flee from before you. And I find that particularly inspiring today. And I think about it in the context of a nation of people who don't, in many cases, even know their identity. But they do begin to understand that they are to serve Yahuwah and that they are called out, and we are sons of Abraham and we are descendants of the B'nai Israel spiritually and probably physically, but at least in the most important sense. And these words ought to really resonate with us. Whenever the ark set forward, Moshe said, "Arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let them that hate you flee from before you." And when it rested, he said the following, "Return, O Yahuwah, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel." And at that point, we get the final line in the book, or the chapter in the book, and the final inverted noon that marks and sets off those two admonitions. All right, chapter 11 says, "Among the people, there were all kinds of folks. They were as murmurers, complainers, and you know the term I like to use, modern parlance, whiners. Speaking evil," it says, this is serious, "in the eyes of the ears of Yahuwah. When he heard it, his anger was kindled. And the fire of Yahuwah burned amongst them." This is really serious stuff, folks. "And he devoured," that fire devoured the uttermost part of the camp. So the people cried out to Moshe. And Moshe prayed aloud unto Yahuwah, and the fire abated. And the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of Yahuwah burned among them. And as you can guess, a lot of times this is not a good sign. "The mixed multitude among them fell a-lusting." They started getting an itch for something that they really wanted to have, and it was going to cause some real problems. "The children of Israel also wept for their own part." So we have the mixed multitude. And notice, oftentimes the entire group is referred to as the mixed multitude, but here, "the mixed multitude among them fell a-lusting." And it says, "the B'nai Israel also, they wept for their own part." So we got kind of a division, and yet people from both sets are engaging in what's going to get a whole lot of people killed. Oh, would that we were given some flesh to eat. We really want some flesh to eat. And here's one of my favorite whines in the book. Well, or my least favorite, I guess. "We remember all the good fish, things we were able to eat in Egypt, Mitzrayim, for nothing. It's free fish. And the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. And now our soul is just plain dried up, because nothing at all here, nothing save this manna, to look forward to." Now, the Bible at this point pauses and said, this manna was like coriander seed. The appearance was like bdellium. So what it seems to be parenthetically telling us is, hey, this was pretty good stuff. They should have been thankful for it. That's at least an indicator of the problem here. "People went about, they gathered it, they ground it in mills, they beat it in mortars, they seethed it in pots, and they made cakes out of it. The taste of it was like the taste of a cake baked with oil." Sounds like a pretty good stuff. And I can imagine that probably after eating it for a long time, they've been over a year at this point out there, maybe they're getting tired, they'd like something else. They got it. They got cakes, mortars, pots, seethed, baked, you name it, baked manna, stewed manna. "But when the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it." Moshe heard all this stuff. He heard the people weeping. Now listen to this. "Family by family, every man at the door of his tent." This was not just a little whining. This was literally a mass of whining. "And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled greatly." So we know how serious it is. Moshe, as you might expect, was displeased. And he said to Yahuwah, "Why are you treating me this way? Why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you put all of the burden of this people, these whiners, upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Am I the one that brought them forth, that you should say unto me, carry them in your bosom as a nursing father carries a suckling child unto the land which you swore unto their fathers?" Now, let's pause here, because what's interesting about this is there's a whole lot of whining going on. And I can't help but think whining is a bit contagious. And it looks like almost there's a little bit of wine creeping into Moshe even at this point. And also the sages tried kind of, I think, to excuse him. We'll point out, wait a minute, Moshe also has another concern here. We're going to see how this plays out in a second. Where should I have flesh to give unto all this people? They trouble me. They're really getting on my nerves with all this weeping, this gnashing of teeth, this whining, saying, give us flesh so we can eat. I'm just plain not able to bear all of this people alone by myself. It's just too much for me. It's too heavy for me. So, he says, here comes a little bit of whine on Moshe's part. If you deal thus with me, just kill me outright, I pray, out of hand. If I have found favor in your sight, let me not look upon my wretchedness. So Yahuwah now says unto Moshe, get yourself 70 men from the elders of Israel. Now this is an interesting response, and we're going to see several things come out of this story. So get 70 men, elders of Israel. Now remember, how many tribes there are? There's 12 tribes. 70 men. If we took 6 from each tribe, that would be 72. So he wants 70, so we're going to have some extras here if you take 6 per tribe. Men that you know to be elders of the people, officers over them, bring them unto the Mishkan so that they can stand there with you. And I'm going to come down, and I'm going to speak with you there, and I will take of the Spirit which is upon you, and I'm going to spread it out. I'll put it upon them, and they will bear the burden of the people with you so that you don't have to bear it all by yourself. And you say to the people the following, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow. Oh, you ready for flesh? You will eat flesh, because you have wept in the ears of Yahuwah, saying, we sure wish we had flesh to eat. It was so good for us there in Egypt in that wonderful slavery. Therefore, you want it? You got it. Yahuwah will give you flesh, and you will eat. Now, so far, the sarcasm is thin, and as you've noticed, I've emphasized it a bit, because we're getting ready to see where it really comes out. And here where the sarcasm just kind of hits the fan. Verse 19 says, you're not going to just eat one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days. You want meat? Oh, you're going to get it. A whole month you're going to get meat, so much till it comes out of your nostrils, until it's loathsome to you, because you've rejected Yahuwah, who is among you, and you have troubled him with your weeping, saying, why do we even bother to come out of Egypt? So, Moshe said, the people among whom I am are 600,000 men on foot. You can see Moshe's thinking practicalities. You're going to give them meat? How much meat's that going to be? We got 3 million people here, 600,000 men on foot, and lots of others. And yet you said, I'm going to give them flesh, not just for a day, but for a whole month? Now, you can imagine, we're going to see a little bit of a comeuppance for Moshe, too, I think. Again, the sages probably disagree. You're not supposed to say too much bad about Moshe, and obviously he is he's letting his hair down a bit here. If the flocks and herds, if all of those were slain for him, would that be enough? Or if all the fish of the sea were gathered together for them, would that be enough? Would that suffice? Now here comes the response. I love this response. Yahuwah says to Moshe, "Is Yahuwah's hand wax short? You don't think I can do it? You just stand there. You watch. You shall now see whether or not my word shall come to pass unto you or not." Oops. Okay, well, I think Moshe probably was a bit taken aback, or at least he got the message. He went out. He told the people the words of Yahuwah. He did as commanded. He gathered 70 men of the elders of the people, and he set them round about the Mishkan, or Ohel, the tent. And Yahuwah came down in the cloud, he spoke unto him, and he took the Spirit was upon Moshe, and he put it upon those 70 elders. And it came to pass that whenever the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but they did so no more. So they did it just for a while. But, now notice folks, the scripture doesn't tell us explicitly, but the math is kind of straightforward here, and it fits what we're reading. There remained 2 men in the camp. Now, why are there 2 men in the camp? The first time I read this, years and years ago, I didn't think about the simple math here. How did he pick them? So if it was 6 per tribe, and that obviously seems to be the implication, that would be 72. He's got 70. Well, where are the extra 2? Here we go. There remained 2 men in the camp, the name of one. And notice, we're not told the names of all of those other 6 men from each tribe, but we're going to get the names of these 2 fellows, the 2 that were left out. Eldad, and the name of the other was Medad, and the Spirit rested upon them. They got some Spirit too, and they were of them that were recorded, but they did not go unto the tent, and they prophesied, not in the tent, in the camp. So, a young man comes running, and he tells Moshe, "Hey, Eldad and Medad, they're out there prophesying in the camp." Like he's tapping on them. This is a bad thing. Moshe doesn't seem to think so. Joshua, son of Nun, minister of Moshe from his youth, answered and said, "My lord Moshe, shut him in." And Moshe said unto him, unto Joshua at this point, "Are you jealous for my sake? Come on, man. Would all that Yahuwah's people were prophets. I'd like to have more folks like this, that Yahuwah would put his spirit upon them." So he's not buying it. He's not upset at all. Moshe withdrew into the camp, he and the elders of Israel. So this was a blessing to Moshe, some of his spirit on those 70, and the extra two, they're out prophesying as well, and this is a good thing. Then there went forth a wind from Yahuwah. Wind, we know that word, right? Isn't that usually ruach? And it brought quails from the sea. Now, quail here is, shalim, plural. And he let them fall by the camp. Listen to this. How many quail are we talking about? Quail come from the sea, and they fell around the camp. A day's journey on a side. A day's journey on one side, on the other side, all around the camp. There are quails for a day's journey. How far can a man walk in a day? Well, normally I'd say it might be 10 miles, certainly 6, maybe 15, 18 if he's a strong man. But wait a minute. How far can you walk in quails? I don't know. I'm suspecting the quails might slow you down a bit, but this is still a whole heck of a lot of quail. And ready for this? This is going to slow you down even more. They were 2 cubits deep. 2 cubits. That's 3 feet deep of quails. That's a lot of quails. People rose up that day, all the night, all the next day, and they got themselves quails. Oh, baby, look at all these quails. They gathered, the one that gathered the least got himself 10 heaps of quails. They spread them all abroad for themselves all around the camp. Now, I'm looking at this and I'm going, think about it. This is almost kind of silly. It's almost, if I was there, I'd hope that I would be wise enough to think, okay, well, if I need a quail, I can go out and get one. But on the other hand, because there's lots of them out there. I don't know how far they go, because I don't know if I can see, 3 feet of quails, how far they go, but they go a long ways. Plenty there. So while the flesh was still between their teeth, they're just now fixing to chew down on this. They hadn't even chewed the first bite yet. The anger of Yahuwah was kindled against the people, and he smote them with a very great plague. So here's a problem. The name of that place was called Kibrot Hatava, because there they buried the people. Kibor, by the way, the root here is grave. The grave of desire, or the grave of lust. They buried the people that lusted. There certainly is a message here, and it's pretty dramatic. Okay, from there, from Kibrot Hatava, the people journeyed unto Hazeroth, and then they abode at Hazeroth. And finally, we're going to see the first few verses of this chapter, chapter 12, and another one of these really famous stories. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moshe because of a Cushite woman whom he had married. Now, I've heard people say, oh, this was probably Zipporah. No, I don't think it is. It's a Cushite. And this is a different woman, it sounds like. That's pretty clear. He's married somebody else. A name is not given, but she's a Cushite. Cushite would be an Ethiopian woman, the way we would probably understand it today. And some would say, oh, is this because she's black? I doubt it. But whatever it is, and I think there's more to it, we'll probably talk a little bit about this. Lots of speculation, as you might expect, on this front. And Scripture is a little bit unclear as to what all the reasons why they're doing this. Anyway, they said, has Yahuwah really just spoken only with Moshe? Hadn't he spoken with us too? Yahuwah heard it. So far, this doesn't sound good. And then it has this little aside. Tells us, the man Moshe, he was really a nav. Now, this is an interesting Hebrew word. First time this appears in Scripture, a nav. The next time is in Job. So, only appears once in the whole Torah, this word. It's translated as humble, or meek, or even poor. But I don't know that poor makes sense in this case. Moshe is rich in spirit. None of them were hurting for possessions, nor were they obnoxiously rich. They certainly had what they needed. Anyway, so Moshe was meek, a nav. I have tended to suggest over the years that there are probably multiple ways to translate this. The meaning is literally right here in this verse. And if there's anything that kind of has leaped off the page over the years to me, I like the term teachable. Moshe, it says, he was above all the men of whatever this Anav quality was. He had more than all of the men on the face of the earth. And meek is okay. Blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the earth. But humble is okay. Humble, well, anyway, teachable. To my mind, teachable fits. You don't have to agree with that. But what we're going to see with Moshe, and this is a characteristic that continues to appear, he makes a mistake, he learns from it. He admits it, too. And it's not quite the same as what we see with David, which is, you know, to suck carpet and to repent. This is more like he has a problem, he learns, he picks up on it. And Moshe is arguably one of the most teachable men, because he learned the whole Torah, right, from Yah, right? That's a pretty amazing understanding. So Moshe was a Nav, anyway. And Yahuwah then spoke suddenly unto Moshe, and unto Aaron, and unto Miriam. So the key here is the word suddenly, I think. We don't see that. Surprise! Why? And he said, come on out here, right now, the three of you, unto the tent of meeting. And the three came out. Now let's stop here, because I'll lay out a bit of the speculation. There are some that suggest, what is the problem here? Maybe they're jealous of Moshe. They're prophets too. We're going to see that. Certainly an element that plays out. But it does have something to do with his second wife, this Cushite. And I have wondered, is it possible that they're saying, hey, you know, you're not doing your husbandly duties to this second wife. Maybe she's not getting the physical loving that she needs, something like that. Now, part of the reason why I suggest that is because of this word surprise here. Now, remember that one of the things we see is that sometimes when Moshe says we're gonna commune with Yah and he's gonna talk to us, then you're to refrain from sexual congress for a while. So is that an element? I can't help but think that at least that's a possibility. That's why this sudden surprise, hey, come on down now, seems to leap off the page to me, because maybe Aaron and Miriam realized, ooh, maybe there's a reason why Moshe is not doing as much of the marriage duties as we might think. So the three came out. Yahuwah comes down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the door of the tent, and he called Aaron and Miriam. They both came forward. And he said, hear now my words. I'm teaching you something. Listen up. And part of the reason why I think Moshe is teachable, too, is this expression. I hear now my words. He's showing them. He's just made the point that Moshe is teachable. Well, now Miriam and Aaron are going to be teachable. Hear now my words. If there's a prophet among you, I, Yahuwah, I do make myself known to him. But I generally do so in a vision. Or I speak with him in a dream. Not the way I do it with Moshe. Hey, he's unique. He is trusted in all of my house. Do you get it? Moshe is a whole different breed. Moshe is set apart. Moshe is like unto no one except himself. Him, and with him alone, do I speak mouth to mouth, manifestly, not in dark speeches, not in the similitude of the way Yahuwah is often beheld, not like we're going to see other prophets do, in other words. So why were you not afraid to speak out against my servant, against Moshe? Are you chastened yet? And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against them, and he departed. Now, it turns out, again, back to this issue, what's the reference to this Cushite woman? And why is that in here? Well, if there was an indication of something to do with the marital issues, and that's why they were on him, or I think really the truth is there's multiple things going on here, and we kind of have to just figure it was a bigger picture. But regardless, they didn't go into the tent at this point, right? They got the message, and maybe it's because they were unclean, or at least not quite ready to go in because of having had recent sexual activity. We don't know. But he was angry, and then he left. Then the cloud was removed from over the tent, and check it out. Look at Miriam. She's white as snow. She's leprous. No, she is a metzora. She has zara'at, but it literally says she was a metzora'at. White as snow. Aaron looked upon Miriam, and yep, look at that. She is white. She is, in fact, a Metzorah. And Aaron now says to Moshe, "Oh, my Lord, do not lay on me, I pray you, this sin upon us. We have done foolishly, for we have sinned." So he gets it. "Let her not, I pray, be as one who is dead, of whom the flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." So both brothers are concerned for their sister at this point. Moshe now cries out to Yahuwah, and he says, "Heal her now, O El, I pray you, I beseech you." So here is the response he gets. Yahuwah says to Moshe, "Look, if her father had just spit in her face, well, shouldn't she hide her face in shame for a week, for 7 days? So let her be shut up outside the camp for 7 days. After that, you can bring her back in again." So they did. They shut Miriam up outside the camp for 7 days. And the cloud stayed, the people stayed, until Miriam was brought in again. And afterward, the people then journeyed from Hatzarot, and they pitched in the wilderness of Paran. And that, of course, is where this portion ends. Miriam is outside the camp. Then she is healed. And then they bring her back in, and they journey to Bamidbar Paran.
So come out of her, O my people, for the time has come to judge Babylon. So come out of her.
Shabbat shalom, folks. Boker Tov. Welcome back. Good morning. We are talking at this point about the chapter, the parsha, that begins in Numbers chapter 8. It's called Beha Alotcha. And it has to do, at least the beginning of it, has to do with the lighting of the candles, of the lamps in the menorah. And there's quite a bit of, I guess you'd say, varying stuff in this week's parsha. It's going to talk about when the camp gets up to go, when the cloud by day leaves, then they pack up and they go. There is a blowing of the silver trumpets that are described here that are going to mark the exodus or the moving along the way. And it talks about how each of the camps goes in order. And the host, first place, was the standard of the camp of Judah. They go all the way through from the east to the south and then around to the north. And if you think about it, this is quite a process. Obviously, we got essentially 600,000 men able to go to war. And along with that, women, children, animals, tents, probably 3 million folks in general. I saw an observation, a claim, and this is probably fairly easy to go through some math and figure out. But essentially, this camp area was a city, 3 million people is a lot of people, 12 miles square. That's a huge place. So a lot of people, and this is a major operation. No wonder there's so much text here given to how the host moves out and when they moved out and how they did it and so forth. And then there's this. Now, I'm going to mention this, and lots of midrash about what are called the inverted noons, this set-apart thing in brackets. It's even been called the book never written. But it says this, over as the cloud was over them by day, and then they set forward. When it came to pass, when they started to move out, when the ark set forward, Moshe would say the following, "Arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those that hate you flee from before you." And I've always found that kind of inspirational. And, you know, again, as I reread that this week, and I think about what's going on in the world today, and I think about the clear indication that so many, indeed, most of the Western world seems to hate him. Hate him. They hate him. They want to kill children. They want to kill millions of people. Literally, they hate everybody that believes in him, that walks in his ways. They are talking about LGBTQ Pride Month. They want transgender queens, drag queens, to go into schools and literally destroy kids. I've got a story here that I was debating whether or not to even mention or not, but I will in this context. FDA green lights mass murder of children. They've been doing it from ages 5 through 12 unanimously. Now, the same committee that voted, "Let's kill kids from 5 to 12, has voted again unanimously to kill kids, in other words, to inject them with the mRNA mods, age 5 and under. This is abomination, folks. Let those who hate you flee from before you. Then I saw this story. This comes from Natural News. Depopulation twofer. Youth suicide rates in research compiled by the Heritage Foundation suggest that the more children are pushed by these abominable haters, those who hate Yah and everything that he says don't do, they mandate. They're pushing kids to become transgendered. They're doing it without parental consent. And the more they do it, the more kids are likely, says this study, to guess what? Either contemplate or be successful in committing suicide. Well, wait a minute. If they don't want to commit suicide, they don't want to cut off their penises and their breasts, then we will inject them with drugs. Oh, yeah, and if that doesn't work, we'll inject them in mRNA poisons. The suicide rate among so-called trans kids is already abnormally high. That includes adults that wish they hadn't done it, compared to the rest of the population. And that rate only increases the further a child is groomed into taking hormone-altering drugs or mutilating body parts. It goes on to say, as a general rule, this has been known for years, what they call gender dysphoria. Prepubescent kids not knowing exactly what they are. And they say, am I a man or am I a woman? I've got an outie or an innie. Maybe that gives me a clue. But it generally resolves itself, say everybody that has half a brain, without medical intervention. And yet, now the mass media and the pride group and all these corporate sponsors from hell are insisting kids need to go trans in order to become their true selves. And if they turn out to kill themselves, so much the better. Isn't that the plan? So let me say it again. There's a lot more going on, but you look at this and you say, doesn't this resonate? Arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those that hate you flee from before you. Now, this is interesting, too, and normally I tend to hear about the first part, because that's the one that, at least when I think about the verse, I remember. But it turns out that the last verse before the inverted noon that closes it off says, when it rested, the cloud in this case, and when it's time to camp, he, Moshe, would say, return, shuv, O Yahuwah, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. And there's a lot of midrash on that, too. Essentially, one of the things that we have to do is return to him. And there's a completion here. This is what the inverted noons set off. This idea about the book never written and all the things that are in here. By the way, it kind of separates some pretty tragic episodes, too, in the history of the mixed multitude. Chapter 11 is going to give us one other indicator of that tragic history. And there's a lot more. Now, I was intending to start, as I occasionally do, with the end of this parsha and work backwards a bit. Because to my mind, the other element that ought to resonate with us today, but obviously I think that part about arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered, we need to get on the table first. But the other part that resonates is chapter 11. And the people, it says, were as murmurers. You know, I like the expression, they were whiners. Speaking evil, he says it outright, in the ears of Yahuwah. When Yahuwah heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of Yahuwah burned among them and literally devoured the outermost part of the camp. And the people, they whined, they cried unto Moshe. Moshe prayed unto Yahuwah. The fire abated, and the place was called Taberah, after the fire of Yahuwah burned among them. And then we're going to get this other story. Now, I'm going to set this other story up. I've seen a number of midrashim, over the years on this one. One of them that I think really, to my mind, kind of resonates, actually two of them, are from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. And almost uncharacteristically, the rabbis tend to be pretty forgiving, if you will, of the major figures in the Torah, especially the primary major figure in the Torah, which is Moshe himself. So it's kind of interesting to see criticism of him, and I really like Rabbi Sacks' criticism for that reason. He has two articles that he wrote over a number of years, and I'm looking at both of them here. I guess the one I want to start with is the one where he talks about a faith, and he's referring to his faith, Judaism, for those that seek to change the world. You've heard the term tikkun olam, or maybe you haven't, but it's a Hebrew expression that means fix the world, tikkun olam. And matter of fact, I'll admit, a lot of times it has negative context, because a lot of the leftist Jews that I know want to fix the world by making it more socialist. And obviously, I have a real problem with that. I have a problem with the claim that it's based on Torah, although there are elements that are. But as you know, the 80-20 rule will get in there and mix things up. But in both of these stories, whether he's talking about the issue of character itself or the dark night of the soul, as he refers to what Moshe is going through here, it's kind of a fascinating study. So what I want to do is go through his comments. I want to go through the Torah part itself. And again, I think what you're going to see is the parallels here are really interesting. Now, as I say that, I've also got to mention there are some anti-parallels too, because clearly these are people who are Bamidbar. They are in the wilderness. Well, we may be headed there, but we're not in the wilderness yet. Remember, the wilderness is a place where Yah would take his people to get them away from the distractions, the evils, the pressures, and all that kind of stuff of the world. He makes references throughout the prophets to taking his bride, his people, out in the wilderness to woo them, to let them hear quiet, and to draw them back, right? Return to the things that were of old, the things that you knew once and you've forgotten. That applies to us too. So it's real important that we understand we're not in the wilderness yet. Now, some of us are trying to come out of and move kind of into the wilderness, but Midbar, I think there's value in that. But at least so far as where the masses of people are at the point where this story takes place, we're not in the same situation. On the other hand, there are some elements that really do resonate. So the story goes like this. The place was called Taberah. They were whining. The mixed multitude fell a-lusting. The children of Israel wept, and they said, "Oh, we sure wish we had flesh to eat. We want meat. Give us meat." Well, you know what? You could almost title this this teaching today, "You want meat? Oh, yeah, you're going to get it till it comes out of your nostrils." "We remember the fish," they said. "We were wont to eat in Egypt. We didn't have to pay anything. They were free. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But here our soul is dried up. All we got is this nasty manna to look forward to." And then the Bible tells us, well, the appearance of manna was like bdellium, and it was like coriander seed, and people did all kinds of good stuff with it. They ground it in mills, beat it in mortars, seethed it in pots, made cakes out of it, and so forth. But obviously, they were bored with manna. They didn't like it. So, in fact, now they're going to whine. And what's fascinating to me is the setup here. Both of these articles by Rabbi Sacks talk about what's the problem. Why is Elohim angry? Why is Moshe angry? Well, for one, gone is their memory of slavery. All they remember was the food. Maybe this is a physical thing. We remember the good food. We don't remember the lack of straw, the nasty working conditions, the bondage, the cruelty. And Elohim's angry about that. He was more than angry. And by the way, so was Moshe. And Moshe, as Rabbi Sacks notes, basically had a complete emotional breakdown. He says to Elohim, "Why have you brought this evil on your servant? Why did I fail to find favor in your eyes that you put this burden, this whole people on me? Did I conceive him? Did I give birth to him?" And he makes a comment in one of the stories. You know, this is kind of like a benchmark of despair. This is Moshe, literally at the point of wishing he were dead. The dark night of the soul. And he says, you know, it's not like we don't see other heroes of the spirit that suffer this dark night of the soul. He recounts King David. I'll come back to that one. Other people that wanted to die in the wilderness, like Jezebel with Elijah. Elijah basically was ready to die. Remember one of the most famous, Jonah. Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh. He went to Nineveh, and then after that, he's really upset for several reasons. One, he prophesied. He didn't seem to want the people of Nineveh to listen. They listened, ironically, and they, in fact, were saved. And Jonah's prophecy didn't come to pass. So was he embarrassed? Was he upset that the people that he didn't want to live lived because they listened to him? In any case, he too wanted to die. So there's a lot of this nastiness. But back to Rabbi Sacks. He says the speech that Moshe gives in Numbers chapter 11, where he says, "Where can I find the meat?" He basically laments a whole paragraph or two here. And Rabbi Sacks says, "Whenever I feel unable to carry on myself, I would read this passage, and I say to myself, you know, if I haven't quite reached that part, I'm okay. Things could be worse. I'm not so bad." Somehow, he says, the knowledge that this greatest Jewish leader of all time, and remember, he has a different perspective here, he experienced this depth of darkness that's empowering. Doesn't mean you have failed. You just haven't yet succeeded. So there's something to see when even the true greats have their times of despair. And with that, Let me go to another one here. His other article goes into a bit more detail, and it sets up why, because it's the why that I think is fascinating. Why was Moshe in such a state of despair? Now, some of it I think is clear, and I usually mention this when I go through the story, and it's part of the reason why I'm hard on these people when it comes to the whining. And why do I use that derogatory term? Well, because you know what, folks? This isn't the first time. It's not the second time. It's the fourth time that these people have been whining. And as Rabbi Sachs puts it, this is kind of an appalling show of ingratitude. Helps explain why Yah is so angry. It's not the first time the people of Israel, the mixed multitude, had behaved this way. The earlier episodes are recorded several places. Well, actually, we've seen the story leading up to here. Book of Exodus, chapters 15 to 17. First, after they crossed the Red Sea. At Marah, they complained, right? And the water's bitter. Then, more aggressively, they protested about the lack of food. We've heard this one. Oh, if only we had died by the hand of Yahuwah in Egypt, then we wouldn't have to do what we're doing now. Why'd you bring us out here in this nasty desert to die? Later, at Rephidim, they again grumbled about the absence of water. Moshe says to Elohim, then, what am I going to do with these folks? They're almost ready to stone me. So, here we are at this week's Torah portion, the place that's become known as Kivrot Hata'ava. And this was not the first time Moshe had faced a challenge, but the fourth. This is the fourth incident of whining. But this time his reaction was over the top. Nothing less than, as Rabbi Sachs puts it, complete despair. Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you? Put the burden of these people on me. Did I conceive them? Did I give them birth? Okay, so forth. This is too heavy for me. If this is the way things are going to be, just put me to death right now. If I found favor in your eyes, don't let me face my own ruin. It's an extraordinary outburst. Now that is kind of undeniable. What's going on here? Moshe prays to die. He is not, again, the first prophet of Israel, or the last, to do so. Elijah. He may have been the first, but he certainly wasn't the last. Elijah. Jeremiah. Remember Jeremiah famously did? I mentioned Jonah already. And equally strange is the reaction. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because of the reaction and the confluence of these events. I don't think the confluence is an accident at all, right? We just had this long thing about how they are in the wilderness and how this is a huge process to head them up, move them out, starting with the east side of the camp and Judah and all the way around to the south and then the west and the north. And again, this is a process that obviously took hours, and then the long march itself to wherever they were going to camp next. But what is going on? Why? And the article and the story goes like this. The reaction gives us a clue. What does Elohim do? Bring me 70 elders who are known to you. Officials of the people, make them come to the tent of meeting, the Mishkan. They can stand there with you. I'll come down, speak with them. They'll help you carry on the burden of the people that you won't have to carry it alone. I'll put your spirit on them. Now, here, Rabbi Sachs points out, let's talk about several things. And I like this understanding because I've talked about the elements. He puts them together in what I think is a really excellent way. This is the fourth time the people have whined. They've seen it before. Somehow or other, this one has built to a climax. And part of that becomes obvious. We'll come back to it. I'll go through it in some more detail in a second. The first time at the Red Sea, arguably, well, this is new to them. But you'd think by now, maybe they've been around the bush a while. They have built the Mishkan. There's a lot going on that should have enabled them to understand. Oh, yeah. And when it comes to Moshe, too, we have this already. Remember? He has already taken too much upon himself. His father-in-law, Yitro, has come and said, hey, you know, you're burning yourself out. You need some help. Let's do some delegation here. Captains of tens, captains of fifties and hundreds and so forth. And bring representatives, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain. Appoint them as leaders. So Moshe did that. Moshe acted on the suggestion. So he has all of this going for him already. He has deputies, assistants. He has a leadership team. What now is different with these 70 elders? It's not like he didn't have a team. So let's go through some of the specifics here. Why the emphasis when Elohim gives him this reply on spirit? He's carrying this burden. I'll take the spirit that's on you and put that spirit on them. Why did the elders need to become prophets? What's that got to do with trying to help Moshe? Being a prophet doesn't help one carry out administrative burdens or the duties of leadership. It only helps in knowing what guidance to give the people. But, hey, if it's about prophecy, one guy who knows what's going on, the guy, Moshe, you'd think that would be sufficient, right? If they're all delivering the same message as Moshe is, well then, great, it's just more voices saying the same thing. If they're not, then there's division, that's not good, and furthermore, they'd be superfluous. They'd undermine what he's trying to say. And that's what Joshua seems to worry about in just a couple of verses on down the line. So, at this point, Rabbi Sacks goes to a number of other midrashim. What do the various rabbis say about it? Maybe it's more people helps him feel less lonely, less by himself. But there are difficulties with all of those. I'm not going to go through the difficulties. I think you can kind of see it. What I want to do is go through the unifying point here. Wait a minute. There's one other element. Regardless of who's right and who's wrong and which rabbis understand what's happening, at the end of the story, somehow Moshe's doing better, right? His anxiety, his despair seems to be gone. His attitude was transformed. And I like the way he puts it. It's like there's a new Moshe at the end of the story standing before us, untroubled by even the most serious challenges to his leadership. And we see the example, I like this one, when the two elders that didn't get picked as part of the 70, those two that were left in the camp, Eldad and Medad, they start to prophesy, not down at the tent of meeting, but just out roaming around the camp. Joshua senses this threat to the authority of Moshe, and he says, "Stop him!" And Moshe replies with unsurpassing generosity of spirit, or surpassing, I guess you could say, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all of Yahuwah's people were prophets, and Yahuwah would put his spirit in them too." And then he notes in the next chapter, here's Miriam. She starts complaining. That's the other story that marks kind of the completion of this portion. And she ends up getting kicked outside the camp with Zaraat. She becomes a Metzora for having undermined her brother, who is, in fact, the most anav, the meekest, the most teachable man on planet Earth. So something's taken place here. What is it? All right. Well, let's look historically. And again, he goes through some more rabbis at this point, but suggests that a fellow named Rabbi Lichtenstein is probably the one that comes closest to it. Now, I like this. He says, the early volatility of the people, the mixed multitude coming out of Egypt, is forgivable. To be sure, they have seen miracles. They have seen things that other peoples would have longed to have seen. Indeed, very few people in the history of planet Earth have ever seen these level of miracles. But, on the other hand, hey, they've also had some challenges. They were faced with the Red Sea. They walked through the walls of water on either side. They were faced with the desert. They were faced with Pharaoh's armies. They were faced, too, with the lack of food and water. Now, first time you don't have food and water, that could be really scary. So that's forgivable. And then they had the greatest offense of all, right? They made the golden calf. That leads to a long pause in the narrative. And the pause, we've talked about this, or at least we've gone through it, it essentially goes from Exodus chapter 25 through the book we are in now, chapter 11. Literally, right up to the place where we've been talking. During this period, in response to Moshe's prayer for forgiveness, Elohim has them build a mishkan, a tabernacle in the wilderness, which will ensure and be the physical place of his presence right there among them. Okay, so we got all these details of the sanctuary, all of the book of Leviticus, lots of information there about what's going on. And now we have this break in the narrative. And we talked about it with the inverted nuns, the book not written. "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those who hate you flee from before you, and then return." So, here comes the key phrase. Between those twin events, at the giving of the Torah, Midbar in the wilderness of Sinai, and the construction of the Mishkan, somehow or other, these people, this mixed multitude, the sons of Israel, are transformed from an undisciplined mass of fugitive slaves into a nation, a unified people whose constitution is the Torah, whose sovereign is Elohim, Yahuwah himself, and whose center, and at whose center, both physically and metaphysically and spiritually, is the Mishkan, the temple, the tabernacle in the wilderness, the visible sign of El's presence among them, with the fire by day and cloud, the cloud by day and fire by night. They're no longer what they were when they came out of Mitzrayim and into Bamidbar Sinai. They're now a holy nation set apart. So, at this point, and after all of that is on the table, now it becomes clear. This is why, and I think he nails it, this is why Moshe is this time, the fourth time around, is so upset when they now whine about food. Okay, they have done it before. They've done it again. They've whined about water. But wait, what's different? They hadn't gone at those earlier points through this spiritual transformation that shaped them as a nation. What really, he thinks, caused Moshe's spirit to break was the fact that no sooner than they left the desert to begin the journey again, okay, they've built the Mishkan, time to roll up, head them out, move them out, and now they go right back to whining. Now, I'll admit, when you look at it that way and you think about the context, I can understand why Yah is upset, and so is Moshe. Because they're now whining, just like they weren't any different than they were before. If that revelation at Sinai, the experience of divine anger at the golden calf, the breaking of the tablets, all of the miracles that they've seen, if that couldn't change them, if the building of the tabernacle itself, the Mishkan, if that didn't change them, what could? Moshe's despair is all too intelligible. For the first time since his mission began, he could see defeat staring him in the face. What can I possibly do for these whining bunch of you-know-whats? Nothing, or so it seemed. Not the miracles of Elohim, not the deliverances, not the revelations, not their creative unified labor. Nothing can change this people from one that thinks about food only into one that grasps the significance of what they're doing. Right here in the presence of the living God, for crying out loud. A unique, ethical, spiritual, historic destiny to which they've been called. Maybe, he says, Elohim alone, from the perspective of eternity, who could see and knew the ends from the beginning, could see what was coming. He could see the Mashiach. He could see, well, the things we're seeing now, all this nastiness, and yet even beyond all of that, something in the way of a hope for the future. But Moshe, here is a mere human being. He doesn't see it. I'd rather die, he says, than spend the rest of my life laboring in vain. Okay, now here he says we got to do some speculation. And it's the speculation that I think is so important because, hey, wait a minute, here we are. I've pointed out some of the parallels, some of the anti-parallels. And to make my point as we go forward into this speculation, here America is, here the Western world is, here indeed the whole world is. We have a planet, folks, that has been transformed by the satanic host, the rulers of the darkness of this age, from a nation, from a world that was prosperous, that had the ability to produce food, to feed lots of people, that had energy sources, and had lots of technology, into one that literally has a world economic ruin on the horizon. The supply chains have been broken, whether people realize it or not. Got 10,000 dead cattle in Kansas this week alone. The food infrastructure and food sources and food processing, they're being burned down. They're being destroyed. They're killing chickens by the tens of thousands. No, by the millions. Tens of millions. Turkeys, ducks. If it's protein, if it's food, they're destroying it. They are fixing to plunge the entire world into famine. We're on the brink of the biggest economic meltdown in human history because we have the biggest debt bubble in human history. The biggest world reserve currency that is nothing but an abomination before Yah. On every front, if you understand where we are, it's going to make the famine that faced Israel at this point look pretty pitiful by comparison. I mean, think of it. The number of cattle that were killed this week alone would have fed Israel for quite a while. 3 million people? 10,000 cows? Do the math. We're seeing miracles of destruction, if you will, brought about by a satanic host. So, I think it's important. Moshe, I'd rather die, he says, than spend the rest of my life laboring in vain. Yah knows the future. He understands what's coming. Moshe doesn't. It's the parallels here that fascinate me. It's the parallels that I want us to think about. And it's, by the way, the parallels that I suspect, I hope, I pray, will give us all some hope for the future as well, as we see some of the things that Rabbi Sacks is fixing to suggest that Moshe saw. Okay, let's start with this observation that he made in the first article. One of the things that might have been on Moshe's mind is that it's easy to take Israel out of Egypt, it seems, but it's real blankety-blank and hard to get the Egypt out of Israel. All right, now ask yourself the question, gee, do you think that's true in America with a K, the satanic host? Anybody that's dealing with relatives, dealing with people that are bound and determined to take the poison poke, they want to take their kids to see drag queen story hour, they don't give a damn what the Bible says about abominations and a man lying with a man as with a woman, they want to celebrate Pride Month, they want to force kids to take the poison poke. This is satanic evil, folks. Most of us can't even believe it, much less wrap our heads around it on what kind of damnable parent from hell would allow their kid to be, well, turned into a transgendered, neutered, penis-cutting-off abomination, and at the same time say, let's poison poke them, too. We don't want them to ever have kids of their own anyway. Of course, we fix that with the hormones. This is hell on earth. We're literally seeing it, hell on earth. And I don't think Moshe was seeing quite the level of hell on earth, even. Let's be honest. But he was seeing people whom he recognized. They've seen things that Americans, Brits, Australians haven't. They've seen miracles. I guess you could say Americans and Brits, we have seen miracles. We've seen a nation that came out of bondage. We've seen a nation that that rose, that built itself, that was founded on certain self-evident truths, became the most prosperous in the history of planet Earth. There's a lot of miracles in there. If you've ever studied what happened on July the 2nd, 1776, you know that was a miracle. Some parallels there. But on the other hand, in both cases, people are still people. People are still human. People can still be deceived. They're being deceived in mass. And you might be able to get them out of bondage, but it is tough to get the Egypt out of Israel. And here we are in a land today where more people are in bondage. More people are in bondage today, folks, on planet Earth than I will suggest have ever been in bondage in the history of planet Earth. That includes 1864. That includes all of Bronze Age, Iron Age, and medieval Europe. Yeah, more people in bondage. And here's the irony. I like to quote this line, and I'll try to give credit, but I don't know. It might have been Frederick Douglass, but anyway, he said, let those who falsely believe they are free rattle their chains. We got a bunch of people in abject bondage, slavery. They're in slavery to debt. They're in slavery to Big Brother. They're fixing to be disarmed. They're so enslaved that they're willing to sacrifice their kids to Molech, and they're too stupid to know it. And here we are. How's that for slavery? So, I guess what I'm suggesting is Moshe had every reason to be kind of upset with those people and with the question of whether or not what he was doing was even worth doing. Here we are today. I don't think there's anybody listening to this or that will that isn't looking at the world and thinking, what the hell can we do? I speak to people, they're blind. They love their slavery. They want to take the next poison poke, right? Einstein said it. What's insanity? It's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That's what it is when they put kids in gun-free killing zones. And then the bad guys, probably at the behest of the three-letter agencies, come in and mass murder a bunch of them in those gun-free killing zones, and they say, hey, let's have more hair of the dog. What hadn't worked before that's got hundreds of kids killed by now, let's kill more. By the way, let's disarm everybody else so we can repeat what Adolf did in Nazi Germany. We can repeat what Stalin did, what Mao did. Let's just be able to disarm people, kill them by the tens of millions. Oh, and we got better bioweapons too. Thank you, Fauci. Let's go, Brandon. We'll kill them by the billions. We are seeing a level of evil, folks, a level of slavery, a level of bondage, and all of us. If you can hear the frustration in my voice, you know it. We share what Moshe was watching and saying, you know, is anything going to make a difference? Now, we know we have the benefit of hindsight, the benefit of Scripture. We understand what the Mashiach did. We understand his frustration, too. He expressed it. I'll come back to that. But what do we do about it? Well, as you know, I almost every week, will point out the scriptural advice that we're given has come out of her. touch not the unclean thing, be separate. Those are things that each of us can do individually. I hear people say, oh, you got to vote. Oh, yeah, that'll fix it. Yeah, just like it fixed it last time when they produced millions of votes with not just 2,000 mules, but a lot more than that. We can rig the machines. Stalin was right. It's not who votes that counts. It's who counts the votes. Don't give me this voting crap. That's not going to fix it. Okay, well, we know that it's, in fact, Yah, Bo Mashiach. When he returns, great. What are we supposed to do until then? We'll be overcomers, stand, having done all to stand, be ready in season and out. Lots of admonition, but basically, sometimes I think we say to ourselves, I wish I could do more. Coming out of her, well, that's good. That helps. Maybe I can save myself and my family. Maybe I can speak the truth boldly as I ought to, and a few more people might watch. Certainly, those are the kind of things that the prophets have done. Those of us who read the prophets can do. You know, I quote Isaiah's job frequently. The remnant will watch. Your job is not to do it. Your job is tell them what I tell you to tell them. John Adams, I quote him too. He said, duty is ours. Results. That's what's up to God. Okay, so back to Moshe. I think we can see the point. We share his frustration. We share his understanding. Sometimes people we love will do stupid things. We've seen them do things that are going to get them killed. We know it. Can we save them? Maybe. Probably not. We can't force them to do things that they're bound and determined to kill themselves. We can advise them. If they're under our authority, if it's a wife or a daughter at home, then we have certain spiritual authority over them to cast down vows and so forth. But again, there are limits. We have to understand the limits of our spiritual authority. We also have the ability, and we should, speak up, answer questions, be ready in season and out to give an account for the hope that's within us. 1 Peter 3, I heard that this morning. That's also good advice. All of this is important. But here is the place where Rabbi Sacks goes with Moshe himself. Okay, there can come a time, he says, in the life of any truly transformative leader where the Son of Hope is eclipsed by the clouds of doubt. No, not about Elohim, not about God. We know his promises are true. We know this. He will do it. It's just a question, will I get to see it? Will anything that I do matters? How much does it matter compared to what he's doing? If I can't force people, by the way, the left will do that. They'll force people. They'll kill them if they can't force them. We know better than that. We speak. We offer that evidence. We offer the logic, the explanations, the personal witness of the hope that's within us. But we don't force them. Am I really making a difference? Am I deceiving myself when I think I can change the world? By the way, this is where I disagree with Judaism and this idea of tikkun olam. I don't try to fix the world. I think it's damned full of hubris to claim that you can. What we can do is what Yah tells us to do. Tell him what I tell you to tell him. Come out of her. Be separate. If the world is intent on going to hell, you can't stop it. Don't have the hubris to think you can. But am I really making a difference? That is a fair question. I've tried. I've given the very best of my human energies, my inspiration, but nothing seems, and here he's paraphrasing what all of us, including Moshe, probably have thought, nothing seems to alter the depressing reality of human frailty, greed, avarice, paganism, lack of vision. I've even told people, given people an understanding of the word of Elohim himself. Certainly Moshe did that. They complain, they whine. They think about food. They don't give a damn about the important stuff, the possibilities, what it is that they're here to do. Such despair, right? He suffers, he mentions others. Winston Churchill suffered from depression. He called it the black dog. All the great leaders, prophets, they like Jonah, Elijah, Jeremiah, we've mentioned that, they prayed to die. Moshe was probably the very greatest of those prophets, number two in the history of the planet. But to him, Elohim gave, and we're seeing in this portion, a singular gift. Now, I think Yeshua, because he was Echad, knew this, but we see, and I'll come back to it. I keep saying I'm going to come back to it. David mentions it, and it's one of the last things that Yeshua says. Eli, Eli, Shabbatani. My God, why have you forsaken me? In his case, if we understand the depth of understanding there, and I don't know that we can, but we can at least witness it, he knew what was coming. He knew what needed to be done, and it was tough. And literally, one of the things that needed to be done at the last minute, he had to be cut completely loose. a disconnect between the physical and the Father that made that final element of the sacrifice, true death, and then resurrection possible. And by the way, he's quoting from Psalm 22, if you hadn't seen that before. Psalm 22, verse 1. So back to Moshe. He was given this gift from Elohim to see the influence he had on others. Now, this is speculative, but I really like the speculation because it kind of answers some questions. And he set this up nicely. 70 elders, going to put your spirit on them. Why? Okay, you know about delegation of authority. What does it do? What's the big deal about these 70 elders going to prophesy? Eldad and Medad. Why does Moshe say what he does? Oh, I wish all of God's people could prophesy and would. What's going on here? Well, for a brief moment, says Rabbi Sacks, Elohim took the spirit of Moshe, the one that was on him, and he put it on them. On not just the 70, but evidently on 72 of them, six from a tribe. So that Moshe could see the difference that his life had made on one group, those 70 elders. And that was enough. And I love this. Moshe needed nothing more. He didn't need their help. He didn't need them to even continue to prophesy. All he needed was this transparent glimpse of his spirit and seeing his spirit reflected in others who prophesied. In other words, Moshe got the gift of seeing what he and his spirit had accomplished through the witness of others. Then he knew that he had in fact made a difference. Little could he have known that he, who encountered all kinds of challenges, in fact, would be so decisive an influence that literally millennia later, people like us today are still studying what he wrote, still looking at and learning from his experiences, the things that he put of literally the word of Yah into print that has been preserved for us. He helped forge an identity that has proven tenacious, probably among the most tenacious in the history of mankind. Now, Rabbi Sacks is going to concentrate on Judaism, but hey, remember, there's more than came out of it than that. We have the Mashiach, that spirit, the line, all of the things that, not just Judaism, but Christianity, right? Even though both of them made major errors and have some real problems in their understanding, the peanut butter and the chocolate, the Reese's Pieces and peanut butter cup effect, still, folks, that legacy endures. And even though there have been attempts to introduce paganism and to twist it and to change it from what it was, still, the level of understanding, the teaching is there. And Yah has preserved it for us. So, Moshe knew his life was not in vain. He had disciples. His vision was not alone. It had been planted in others. Others would continue his work long after his lifetime. Remember, Moshe didn't even get to enter the land. And yet all of those who bore his spirit through the generations, in other words, the descendants, spiritual and otherwise, those who study, those who went, even those who went and then had to leave because they were kicked out, we still have that legacy. We still have elements of that vision. This was enough for him, as he says it must be for us. Once Moshe knew that, he could face any challenge with equanimity, and indeed he did. Except for that one little exception years later. But that's another story. All right. So he was still human. And that's probably true of all of us as well. Even having seen it, we still make mistakes. But the key is, and he writes it this way, you know, we often never really know how much we have given to others. What kind of influence we're going to make. I think that's part of the resonance of this Isaiah's job that sits with me. That was one of the things I took from the story. I've talked any number of times about that that article from Albert J. Nock written, 80-plus years ago at this point. Tell them what I tell you to tell them. You're not going to know. Matter of fact, it's not in your job description. Hey, Elijah, there's 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. You know what? You don't have to know who they are. I do. Doesn't matter that you don't. They're there. Your job tell them what I tell you to tell them. If you think about it, folks, it's an aspect of the very same thing. Our job, walk in obedience. Tell them what I tell you to tell them. Elijah didn't know how much influence his prophecy was going to have on future generations. Moshe, bless his heart, Moshe got a glimpse of it. I don't even know if that glimpse was enough to let him see just how profound it was. Maybe it was. We're not told what Eldad and Medad and all those others were prophesying. I can't help but think now, maybe he was showing them some of what we're seeing today. Maybe there were all kinds of things. We don't know what they were prophesying. It's not written down for us. That's the case in so much, right? We're told that in the life of Yeshua, there's a lot of stuff. Fill lots of books. We don't know about some of that either. But what we do know is what we, each of us, are supposed to do. Elohim gave Moshe himself a glimpse of what lay beneath the surface. He showed him how his spirit had entered into others and the effects that it would have. And that too should be enough for us. It's what we need to be doing at this point in our lives. And as we look at the level of challenges, I find that to be an extremely uplifting concept. I love that idea because certainly, and I do tend to focus on that. I have people say, "Well, gee, Mark, there's so much really nasty negative stuff going on." Well, you know what? There is, folks. This is arguably the most nasty, evil, negative time in human history. We may see nukes. If the Biden Fuhrer and those who are jonesing to see if they can't kick off World War III, if they get their way, the satanic hosts, they intend to kill billions. Wrap your heads around that. This is truly satanic level evil. They're killing kids. They're destroying. They're killing kids before they're born. California this week will kill them post-birth. They are executing them in mass. Oh, let's kill kids 5 to 12. Oh, yeah, that works so good. Let's kill them to vaccinate them against something that doesn't work. And against a disease that isn't going to hurt him anyway. How evil! I can't express it enough. How blankety-blanken! I almost said a bad word. How evil is that? It's hideously evil. It makes Molech sacrifice look tame because of the numbers involved. Same process. Whether you burn them, poke them, or cut off their genitalia and kill them. It's the same. It's about death. It's about choosing death. Well, we're told to choose life. We live at the most important cusp, I will suggest, in all of human history. As many miracles as the people there in Mount Sinai, Bamidbar, as many miracles as they saw, you know what? We're going to see more. We're going to see challenges that make a little bit of thirst in the wilderness, a little bit of hunger in the wilderness look pretty tame. Like it or not, folks, the biggest famine the world has ever seen is on the horizon. Perhaps nuclear war, certainly biological warfare has already been unleashed. How evil can it get? Answer, you ain't seen nothing yet. Does that sound negative? Well, understand the positive side. Pray that we will see that the truth will be revealed. It is being revealed. He's promised that. Nothing hidden. We'll stay that way. It's going to come out. We're going to see it. We don't necessarily know. This is the challenging part. We don't know, at least not in this lifetime, the effects that we're going to have on others. We don't know what the things that we witness to, the ready in season and out part to give a reason for the hope that's within us. We don't know the effect that that's going to have. Our job, tell them what I tell you to tell them. Walk in obedience. Do what I tell you to do. Keep my Sabbath. Teach your children. Take care of things you can take care of. Come out of her. Be separate. Don't touch the crap that the world wants to use to destroy you and your children and people you don't even know and their children. Walk in obedience. Do the things that I have for you to do. Trust in that. It's literally the message from every single prophet. And it involves teshuva. I've often said, because it's true, the single unifying thing. Prophets had different messages. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. You know, it's not about predicting the future. That's not what defines a prophet. The real message of the prophet was consistent. Always consistent. Teshuva. You're going the wrong way. You're heading for a cliff. You're heading for death. Turn around. The path you're on leads to death and destruction. Don't go there. Turn around. What was it that we saw in this book never written? Whenever the ark set forward, Moshe said, "Arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered, and let them that hate you flee from before you. May it be so, folks. That is no less true today. Not in the least less true than it ever was. It is far more important today for us and for our lives and our children and those we don't know and their children. It is far more important that we say, "Arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those that hate you flee from before you." We have this power and authority in His Word. And how does the book never written end? When the ark rested, when it came time and place for them to camp, then he, Moshe, would say, "Shuv, turn, return, O Yahuwah, to the tens of thousands of the families of Israel." This, in fact, is where we are today. This, in fact, is what we need to understand today. It's time for us to return, shuv, and to admonish, implore, pray that He return unto the tens of thousands of families of the B'nai Israel. And that should include us, and it does include us. And all we have to do is walk in obedience to that. Let's pray at this point. If there are some questions in the next couple minutes, or if I am moved by the Ruach to talk about some of the related items specific to today, we'll do that in a minute. But I want to pray first. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we come before you. We thank you, Father, for your word. We thank you for the prophecies that you have given to your people, arguably the vast majority of which have never been written down. Things that I'm sure you are still showing us. Young men will dream dreams, or old men will prophesy. Lots of things, we think I got that backwards, but we got it. We're going to see things. We're going to understand things. You're going to show us things, both in the spiritual sense and in the real sense. May we be ready, Abba. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Help us to be found worthy to escape the things that are coming upon the earth. Help us to be found doing your work when you return. Help us to know what it is that you have for each of us as individuals to do. To come out, to be separate, to speak your truth boldly, to do the things you have for us to do. Show us those things, Abba. Help us to be where we need to be so that we can do what it is you have for us to do. Help us to be ready in season and out. Father, we know that there are going to be challenges. We know about the man's enemies. They'll be those of our own house. We've already seen it. People that we love, people that we care about, are committing suicide, literally. They're taking the injection. They will take the mark, some of them. We pray that it's not all of them, and it's not those, Abba, that we have anything that we can do to help. And when we can't do it, we trust that you will. We pray that you will put a hedge around them, block the paths that lead to death and destruction. Guide us that we would be witnesses for all of those that can and will turn. And let it be so. Give us the strength, Father, to deal with the things that we simply can't change. Give us your authority and your understanding. Give us these eyes to see and ears to hear that we can know the difference. Change the things we can. Affect the people that will be affected. And we pray too, give us a glimpse. Show us what it is we need to know, that we would be strong and of good courage to walk in this time ahead, to face the challenges. Chazach. And above all, we pray to be good and faithful servants unto you. This we ask in your set apart name, for you are our King, our Savior, our Redeemer, our help in times of trouble. You are Yahuwah Zediknu, Yahuwah Vitzivenu, Yahuwah Zevuot. You are our El Shaddai, our healer, Yahuwah Rapha, our banner, Yahuwah Nisi. And we thank you and praise you. Hallelujah. Amen. Okay, let me take a quick peek here and just see if there's anything that I really feel moved that I do have to mention. I outlined a couple of these stories. This shouldn't do anything except just make the point clear about how the federal death agency is now saying, let's kill more kids, going to kill them under five. We'll unanimously agree. You know what? I'll say it. I don't know. I don't believe in the Catholic conception of hell. I do know that there is such a thing as Sheol, and that there is Gehenna, and that there are there is a trash pit, and that there is a lake of fire. And I think that there are certainly lots of people calling themselves MDs and doctors like Mengele and Fauci and others who deserve to burn in that lake of hell for the evil that they're doing. And I don't know if they can be saved or not, but if they can't, then let them burn. Because so much evil is being done here today. So many things, folks, that... Well, I guess I'll put it this way. I talked about this on the Come Out Her My People show this week. If you go back and look at Scripture, there were a whole lot of people. Maybe they weren't even people. Maybe they were satanic hosts, Raphaim, descendants of the half-breeds. Their DNA was no longer human. But there were a whole lot of people grouped. The Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, that Yah said, you know what? You offer these other groups that aren't inhuman, you offer them peace before you attack the city. And if so, then you kill all the men, but you save the women alive, you take prize. But when it comes to those that are needing dying, you kill every last man, woman, and child, and even the animals. Probably because they too were half-breed chimeras. Anyway, that's a tough lesson for us. And I find that of late I've been watching and looking and thinking about that a lot more. I look at people. You could name the names. I do frequently. And what in this context and this context alone... Yeah, I will. Okay, there are people that have run for high office. There are Hitleries of the world. There are those who have committed acts of treason against the United States. I've named one of them already. The Fuhrer, the Fauci Meister, the fellow that helped develop a bioweapon, then lied about it, and then released it, and is still lying about it, and still jonesing to kill more kids and more people. These people are satanically evil servants of the Most High. I don't know that they're human. Yah does. It's beyond my pay grade. But I do know this, folks, that when it comes time for a judgment, if the United States is not able to say, you know what, there are crimes deserving of death, and if we can't put people to death who need dying, then we deserve the nation to die, as it looks like Yah is fixing to make happen. Because we have failed to do what? Justice, justice, you shall pursue. There's no justice. There's not even a hint of it. There's a fake. Look at the January 6th committee. So much crap. What did I see? Here's a story. This is right in this wheelhouse. A New Mexico county commissioner in Otero County, the guy's name is Coy Griffin, he stood up and said that the illegitimate voting machines there were committing mass fraud. He refused to certify the primary election. He has been basically speaking out and saying, we don't want these voting machines. Well, guess what? He was sentenced to jail for daring to peacefully protest the election theft in 2020. This is what they're doing, folks. Those that speak up, they're suffering for having been correct, been right, been on the side of the Creator, been on the side of the angels, if you will. And those that are doing evil... they're killing, they're multiplying their evils. May Yah judge them. May they burn in the hell that they so richly deserve, and the literal hell on earth that they are trying to push, to foist on planet Earth. I'm going to mention two more things just by way of, okay, here we are, what do we do, come out of her, how do we physically walk in these days? This one I'm not going to go through, but I will mention it, and I certainly will encourage folks to find this article and look at it. It was on Zero Hedge, talking about one of the economic things you're going to see. Remember, people in this time, they were jonesing for meat. We want meat. We want it so bad we can taste it. Oh, you're going to get it. You're going to get it good and hard. And they did. A lot of them died before they even chewed the first bite. Wow. There's a message there. I think that message still resonates with us. Well, we're going to see some other elements as well, and I encourage people. One of the things we can do is prepare and plan in advance. Here's an easy one. Housing crash imminent, said this piece from Zero Hedge. As mortgage rates now explode, price cuts soar, buyer demand collapses. The article goes on to say, hey, remember how not long ago you could put a house on the market and sell it the same day? Well, U.S. housing is now imploding fast, with subsequent observations confirming a dire conclusion about the state of the most popular asset class of the U.S. middle class. Things have gone from worse to catastrophic. 30-year mortgage rates are now soaring at the fastest pace on record to, again, above 6%. Remember when they were down in low single digits? Levels that you last saw before the housing bubble burst. Okay, so basically what they're saying is, you got a house to sell, you're probably too late, but if you haven't sold it, you better do it. Get it while the getting's good. And we are now seeing the highest share of sellers on record that have dropped their price during the last 4 weeks, ending this last week, as mortgage rates shot up to levels not seen since 2008, with the last economic crisis. All right, there's more on that story. It goes on for page after page. But basically it says, oops, it's too late. Here's another one. This is from Brandon Smith, and he has a good Austrian economic background as well. The engineered stagflationary collapse has arrived, he said. Here's what happens next. Now, what happens next? He's talked about, I've talked about, I think any Austrian can tell you what happens next. Although there are some differences. I've often joked, will it be fire or will it be ice? In other words, will we see a deflationary depression? Will we see a hyperinflationary depression? Or, as he puts it, a stagflationary collapse? And he basically points out why he believes it'll be stagflation as opposed to some of the other ways that currencies collapse. Production of fiat money is not the same as real production within the economy. Trillions of dollars in public works, right, the fake communist jobs, may create more jobs, but it also inflates prices and the dollar goes into decline. Wages have to be adjusted constantly as prices increase, or people might have jobs, but they still can't afford to live. Now, the catch-22 is that when inflation becomes rampant, the Fed is compelled, or at least they'll claim they are, to raise interest rates significantly, well, like they're doing now, because they've lost control over a short period of time. In other words, the choice is either stagflation or a deflationary depression. So it's clear now, this week, what the Fed has chosen. They have chosen the stagflation. And he goes on to say, well, what's that going to look like? But you can guess, right? We're going to see some whipsawing. You may have a brief period here if there are things that you have cash set aside for. Home appliances, for example, given a collapse in the housing market, guess what's going to be available? Well, movers, if you need to move, they're going to have a tough time. How about new furniture, new appliances for houses that aren't being built? Yeah, you can kind of see that. Those that have them on the shelves in inventory are going to want to get rid of them. But guess what? There won't be any more when they're gone. So you get this whipsaw, bullwhip effect, they call it. Prices go down only until they clear the inventory, and then shazam, they go through the roof. And furthermore, they get worse because eventually things like that, new cars get scrapped for the steel that's in them because nobody wants to buy the ones that don't have gas to run anyway. So we're seeing, if you follow through here, a whole lot of really nasty stuff. It is a collapse of biblical proportions. And again, it's about his people being prepared. It's about his people understanding and doing the best we can to come out and to be separate and to be ready for what's coming, because what's coming is here. Let's wrap up with the Aaronic blessing. We remember that Yahuwah spoke to Moshe saying, speak in turn to Aaron and his sons and say to them, this is how you bless the B'nai Israel. Say to them, Yivarekaka Yahuwah Varishmareka Yair Yehuah Panavaleka Vechuneka Isayahu Penavalecha Viasim Lecha Shalom. May Yehuah bless you and keep you. May Yehuah make his face to shine upon you. May Yehuah lift his countenance upon you and give you his shalom, Omein. And thus he says, they shall put Shemi, my name, on the B'nai Yisrael, and I myself shall bless them. And may it be so.